Welcome to the Brute Strength Podcast, bringing you worldwide experts from all areas of health and fitness. We cover training, nutrition, coaching, and mindset. Welcome your host, strength and conditioning coach, 2012 and 2013 CrossFit Games champ, Michael Cashew. Mind, body, brute.
Hello, hello. This is Mike Cashew, and you're listening to the Brute Strength Podcast. This week's guest is the owner of Beyond Macros, Matt Walrath. Matt is a super cool dude, and he's teaching nutrition. He's coaching people in their nutrition in a very, very unique way. We talk about how he connects with people as a coach and what you can learn from that. We talk about the meaning behind his company, Beyond Macros, and he lays out a very sustainable approach to nutrition. We talk about why focusing on quantity over quality first makes the most sense long term, habits and mindsets for sustained success in nutrition, and a lesson that he learned about body language by being around a bunch of naked people. Matt is just a super interesting guy with a very holistic approach to nutrition and life in general, and I think you're going to learn a ton from this. If you've got time, leave me a quick review on iTunes, and if you love the show, please share it. Thanks and enjoy the show. Matt Walrath, what's up, dude? How are you?
I'm great, man. I got to wipe my booty with the toilet paper you sent. Really appreciate that.
Absolutely, man. Anytime. Let me know if you need a refill. So I want to talk nutrition, lifestyle, storytelling. We have so many things to talk about. And one of the things that I love most about you, and I've only hung out with you for a day, but what I gathered really quickly and from doing a little bit of research about you, you're really authentic and vulnerable person. And you seem to be doing some serious work on your own personal development, which is something that I value so much. And I know the courage that it really takes. And you told me you had a story about your mom teaching you how to be vulnerable in the first place. What's the story behind that?
Oh man, coming out with the heater right away. Yeah, that's.
I didn't know it was a heater. You just said you had a story.
Yeah, I mean it is. Yeah, I know. I didn't give you much there. And so, just to give some context, I grew up in a very wealthy conservative area in New Jersey, and everybody that I saw, friends, siblings, my friends' parents, my parents, everybody really projected strength. They always had this mask of everything is okay. You always heard, or I always heard things like, you know, your problems are small. What about the starving kids in Africa? This or that. And for most of my childhood, I was never given permission to feel my negative feelings. It was always, you can't have those. You're a child of privilege, and everybody around you is modeling that everything's good, project strength. And wearing that mask of strength for so long, I eventually cracked in high school. I grew up in a small town. Your reputation follows you. And as soon as I realized that most of my reputation, most of my personality up to that point was not authentically me, I really had this internal struggle with it because I didn't know how to approach being authentic, because people had known me for 16 years up to that point since I was a kid, and they had their idea about who I was. And seeing that reflected back to me, anytime that I went to make a change, it was met with resistance. And as a young kid, that was scary to me. And it led to a lot of depression and anxiety throughout high school. And I really didn't see anybody modeling vulnerability and being able to talk about their problems. So when it really came to a head and I was really at just like the lowest low, just really considering just ending things, my mom picked up on it. Like, she had that motherly sense and just came into my room, gave me a big hug, asked me what was going on. And I think that's probably the first time I had cried since I was like a baby. And I cried like a baby. And my mom was just like, oh my God, this is what's been wrong. I know what you feel like. I went through these things when I was your age. You know, I still go through these things. And I was like, oh my God. Cause my mom is a very, she falls very much to the masculine side of the feminine scale. Mm-hmm. And so I just thought, whoa, like my strong ass mom feels the way that I feel. And just having that for the first time, having somebody, especially my mom, showing me that it was okay to feel that way was a big breakthrough. I think that's really the point in my life where I felt like, okay, I can do this. Like I can live and I can be happy. I can be sad. And yeah, so I have my mom to thank for the path that I've been on.
Wow, man. What a powerful story. Well, how did that change your experience of the rest of high school? Cause I think you were 16 or 17 at the time, right?
Yeah. So unfortunately, again, I was from a wealthy conservative area. And most of the time, the solution is, okay, let's take you to the doctor. And the doctor, the solution is, oh, you feel depressed and anxiety? Here's some antidepressants. Here's some anti-angiolytics. And so I was hit with a kitchen sink in terms of medications. And it really restricted my ability to feel the full spectrum of emotions.
Right.
And to add to that, I also, as a young whippersnapper, developed a rather heavy daily cannabis habit. And the combination of the two really restricted my ability to feel those emotions. I would say it wasn't until I was about 23 or 24 that when I removed the cannabis from the equation, that things really started to open up for me emotionally. However, I definitely felt a lot more hope for what the future could hold. And my first year of college is really when I decided that I could be the architect of my own life.
Yeah. So you went to college. Take us through that journey a little bit, because I think you went in for one thing and came out for another. What were your college years like?
Oh man. Yeah. So I played lacrosse in high school and college, and I ended up going to an engineering school in New Jersey where I grew up, and I was not being exposed to, I really should have started with a liberal arts education, but I was just being exposed to business and engineering classes. I wasn't being exposed to anything in the arts outside of that. And that was tough for me, especially going through another winter in New Jersey. And I had a phenomenal lacrosse season. Actually, that was another pivotal year in my life when one of the alumni who had an award named after him, just because the guy went from a zero to a hero on the team. Beside the point, he really drove home the story that his story was all about luck, and luck is where the hard work he put in met the opportunities that he was given. Mm-hmm. And that really opened up my ability to see that I could be the architect of my life. And that and a psilocybin experience in that same year really solidified it. And I moved out to California. I really knew that I wanted to get a liberal arts education. I enjoyed my business classes more than engineering classes. So I went in that direction, ended up out in California. And the year I got out there, I saw this one class that had the most California title to the class you could ever imagine. It was Eastern Philosophies of Health and Healing. And I thought, you know what? If I'm going to get the true California experience out of my California education, I need to take this class. And so I ended up taking this class, and we're learning things like meditation and different complementary and alternative medicine practices and modalities. And that really opened up a lot of my philosophies I carry with me today in my coaching.
That's amazing, man.
Yeah. So
after college, you ended up getting a marketing job first, I think, right?
Yeah, that was actually a job created. So a couple of friends and I decided that we loved events and we loved marketing. So why not start an event marketing company?
Right.
And Makes sense. So it was really fun at first. I mean, we were challenged by having to create an app for these events. We were challenged by having to market and sell and all these things. And that was fun until probably our third event, when I realized, holy crap, man, I'm helping companies give out more promotional products that are going to end up in a landfill. And right. That's so against my moral code. I felt like I was working against myself. I felt like it was a zero sum, if not a negative sum thing that I was doing. So eventually I came to the realization, I've got to leave this. Even though I put all that sweat equity in, I need to leave this.
So you ended up feeling like it wasn't fulfilling to you, right?
Yes, absolutely.
And what did that mean to you then? What does that mean to you now?
Yeah. So at the time again, bringing up another psychedelic experience, I had an experience with a plant called Iboga around that time. And I really call it the master integrator because it's something that the effects of it last for 72 hours. So after the initial experience, I was still going about my daily life while I was still experiencing the effects of that plant. And it created this dissonance in me whenever I was doing something that was outside of my moral code. It was really like, man, like, you know, ignorance was bliss, but you are no longer ignorant. If you do things that go against your moral code, you've got to live with those consequences and it's not going to feel good. Mm-hmm. And that was the feeling. As soon as I went back to that work, because I had taken a little bit of time off to consider it, I did a little bike ride from San Fran to Los Angeles, went to Burning Man, and then had that Iboga experience. And after I came back from that, I was like, all right, let's see. Like, I have all these realizations. Can I actually go back and do what I was doing? And within a week, I knew I was just completely on the wrong path.
Wow.
And that's when I ended it.
And what did that feel like to be on the wrong path? Like what were you thinking? What were you feeling that let you know, hey, I'm on the wrong path and I need to change it right now?
When I think about where the feeling is in my body, it's like right where your rib cage opens up in the front of your chest right there, deep in there. That's where I felt it. It was like a knot in there. Why are you doing this? And it was this constant feeling of, as I'm doing the things, my brain's going elsewhere. And that's actually a litmus test that I use now to figure out whether or not what I'm doing is something I should be doing. If my brain starts going towards, go read about something you're interested in, go on social media, whatever, while I'm doing a task, I know that task is not something I should be giving my attention to. Mm-hmm. And that was a realization at that point that I got.
Gotcha, man. That's powerful. Yeah. So then I think you go immediately into doing nutrition for people in a space that's very achievement oriented, like the CrossFit functional fitness space. And yet you have a very different approach to nutrition. How did all of this start to happen?
Yeah. So I actually started taking my precision nutrition level one while I was a senior in college because I only had one class. It was a nutrition class. It was 3 hours on a Thursday, my senior lacrosse season in the spring. So I had heard about precision nutrition. I started taking that course and I absolutely loved what I was learning. And I had this stark contrast versus this food pyramid, diabetes management nutrition class I was taking in college. Mm-hmm. And from there, I also was being exposed to paleo and zone from CrossFit because I got my level one back in, I want to say, 2010. And I remember we spent about 15 minutes on the zone diet. I was fascinated and experimenting myself. Plus, I was getting all of this information about Ayurvedic medicine and traditional Chinese approach and all these different alternative ways of thinking about wellness. And it was really a process of synthesizing that. I decided that I was going to 100% commit to different diets and different dogmas, test them out, and do my best to take that Bruce Lee approach of just integrate what works and leave behind what doesn't. And I mean, it took years before I really ironed out my approach and managed to have consistent success with clients.
So your company is called Beyond Macros. What's kind of the meaning behind that? And what's your general philosophy? Like how is what you're doing different from other nutrition coaches in this industry?
Yeah. So we go beyond macros in the sense that when people come to us, oftentimes getting the right quantity of food is important for reaching their goals. And I'm sure, as you know, it's like with WAG, it's like if you get someone's macros right and they start to see some progress towards their goals, they're going to start trusting you more as a coach. Mm-hmm. And they're going to start trusting the process more. So we use the quantity first approach, and we use the quantity as a guide to shifting somebody's habits. Because by shifting the habits and getting the habits to be second nature, or at least to getting the better choice from a nutrition perspective to be automatic, then that's how we create a sustainable transformation. And I think that's one of the things that's a little bit different from a mindset of my coaches and I, is we're thinking about, okay, we've got to get somebody some results right now. And we have to think about how what we're doing right now is going to affect them 90 days after they're done working with us. Because there's just so much that comes into play. If I give somebody the right macros, but everything else in their life is just off. They're sleeping like crap. Maybe they exercise, but they're exercising too hard. They're not very active. They're not giving themselves time and space for inner work. Then the context that they've set up for themselves isn't conducive to maintaining that progress. The National Weight Loss Registry, if you look at the common denominators, this is a registry of people, over 5,000 people who have lost weight in diet trials and managed to maintain most of their weight loss. And one of the most common things is that those people have put the focus on changing their habits and their environment. So we look to go beyond in the sense that we need to help someone set up an environment and a context for their life that is conducive to continuing to progress even after they're done working with their coach.
So what's the flip side of that? Like what obviously most diets fail. Why do they fail? Like what are most people doing that's not working?
I can tell you from experience when I was offering people meal plans right after I finished PN,
right,
that the issue was a lot of times those meal plans represented almost a 180-degree shift from what was normal for that person. It didn't take, it took into account what foods they liked. I had them do kind of a stoplight of different foods and then would make a meal plan there. And then they'd go out to eat and they wouldn't know how to adjust, or, you know, they'd have one cheat meal and they wouldn't know how to adjust. And there was no real education there.
Right.
And then the other flip side too is a lot of times diets don't work because a lot of these diets aren't actually changing people's habits, and they leave a lot of the slippery slope foods in. You know, if you have somebody who they're super gung-ho because they hired a coach and they managed to fit, let's say, 3 spoonfuls of Halo Top into their macros for the 90 days they're working with their coach, mm-hmm. then they're done working with their coach. Coach isn't there looking over the shoulder, but Halo Top is still in the freezer staring at them every time they open it. And if that's a slippery slope food for them, then maybe 3 tablespoons turns into 4. Like, treat yourself, right? You just lost 15 pounds. You hired a coach. You did everything you were supposed to. And then the slippery slope happens. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of different willpower traps. I think The Willpower Instinct by Kelly McGonigal is a phenomenal book that highlights a lot of these things that happen to dieters after they are done with the initial diet phase. And I think it can help people inoculate themselves against some of the traps that one would experience after a major change like a diet.
Yeah, I kind of look at it, to use your meal plan example, I look at it like you're giving someone a stencil to make a piece of art. And as soon as the stencil is not there, they have no idea how to draw anymore, right? Because they never learned it in the first place. So if you get a meal plan, or you have someone telling you exactly what to eat, that works as long as that support is there. And as soon as the support is not there, like you go out to eat, or you go over to a friend's house, or you stop working with the coach, you have no idea. You haven't built the skills or instilled the habits necessary to navigate your own nutrition. So we have a very, very similar approach, man.
Yeah, exactly. And it's interesting. I forget which book I read it in recently, but there was a saying in there that no plan survives contact with the enemy. It's a military thing. And so they create commander's intent. So it's like, okay, we can do this plan and have all these contingencies, but as soon as we make contact, it could happen that every plan and every contingency falls apart. So everybody on the team needs to know what the commander's intent is for that mission. If we need to go capture that hill and the ways that we rehearsed it aren't going to work out, at least we know the direction that we have to move in, and we can play pickup basketball. We can be moving on the fly together. And I think that's an important analogy to diet and nutrition coaching.
Hey guys. If your biggest goal right now is to lose body fat and or build lean muscle mass, then we have something cool for you. and it is called, wait for it, The Brute Body Shred Manual. I know it's a super cool title. So this is a short ebook that includes 27 different tips on building lean muscle mass and losing body fat. It includes a 6-week pull-up progression, some different programming for building lean muscle. We have fat loss myths in here. We talk about how to eat for body composition goals and a ton of different things that you can implement immediately, or just things that are kind of mindset shifts that can help you reach your goals over the long term. And you can get access to this by going to brutestrengthtraining.com/SM, brutestrengthtraining.com/SM. And this is a free guide. Take advantage of it. Hope you enjoy. So you already started to answer this, but just to highlight and even dive a bit deeper, why not build habits? So you talked about quantity first. Why not focus first on building quality or building habits around eating more high quality food, what you would consider nutrient dense whole food?
Because we take an integrated approach where we take a look at the food somebody is already eating. And when we're making recommendations for them to adjust their quantity, we'll make specific food-based recommendations using our knowledge about which foods tend to be high nutrient density. The other reason I don't take a quality first approach is just because quality is so highly variable from person to person. You could have somebody who has SIBO, which is a small intestine bacterial overgrowth, and if you feed them a diet full of broccoli and fruits and a lot of high FODMAPs foods and a lot of fermentable fiber, you could cause more bloating and issues than they had on perhaps a standard American diet. So the thing is, like, quality, it varies so much from person to person that I think it takes getting to know that client, getting them some results before you start experimenting with more specific things in terms of quality. And with that said, I just interviewed Dr. Ben House for my show, and he brought up a great point that the thermic effect of food, so the amount of energy that your body takes to actually break down, process, and store, use the nutrients from your food, you can get, if you switch from processed foods to whole foods, you can sometimes get like a 15% thermic effect. So, you know, most of the people I put on a 15 to 20% calorie deficit to lose weight anyway, if you can get that for free just by switching from processed to unprocessed foods, that's a simple enough quality switch right there that you kind of get some free calorie deficit in there for the weight loss people.
Amazing. So in your opinion, what are the key habits necessary for being consistent with meeting an energy balance requirement, like a set of macros?
Yeah, I really think that the first thing is becoming aware of your current habits and routines. That's something where in the first video chat meeting we have with all of our clients, we like to, and I stole this from the guy who started Shake Shack, we collect the dots before we connect the dots.
Ah, yeah.
So we really want to know, okay, what is somebody's current preferences, habits, and routines? And then once we figure that out, then we can figure out what the highest impact habit change is going to be for that individual. However, most people who come to us, it's changing now that there's a lot more macro coaches out there and people have used MyFitnessPal, but a lot of people who were coming to us, let's say 2 years ago, didn't really have a good idea about the foods they were eating. I would still have people who were surprised that if they went to Five Guys for lunch, that it was 1600 calories. So for a lot of people, it's just that self-tracking and self-awareness. That's an important habit to get in first. And then from there, I think it's really important to make sure that somebody carves out the space for meal prep. And I also think it's important to let people know that meal prep doesn't have to be this terribly daunting thing that you do every Sunday and it takes up your entire afternoon. And it really can be something as simple. I think it falls on a spectrum. It can be as simple as hard boiling a dozen eggs, which is an extremely passive meal prep option that takes 15 minutes and you've got snacks for the week. Or it could be all the way up to like Juju Mufu's Great Wall meal prep, where you've got every meal you're going to eat for the week in food containers ready to go. And then there's things that fall in the middle on the spectrum. The way I do it is I just cook leftovers at dinner. That way I have lunch for the next day. So yeah, I think meal prep is the keystone habit for most people.
Awesome, man. And like you're saying, it is all so personalized. And one thing I noticed that you said was that the first step is building awareness, which is really the way to improve anything in your life, right? As soon as you become aware of a way that you could improve, it starts to, you start to set yourself up for success. You start to notice when you're acting out of an alignment, or you notice this little bad habit that you have, and you can start to correct it. I think that's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So you do a lot of what sounds like life coaching with people by helping them get in touch with their values and like what, you know, where they really want to go with their overall health. How are you doing this? What's some of the conversation that you're having to really connect with people and understand, or help them understand where they're going?
I really like to just ask a lot of questions. I feel like as coaches, people feel like they have to constantly be telling the client what to do. Like when I train coaches to coach for us, the first thing that I really have to get them to unlearn is that need to give a million different recommendations. Because if you just ask the right questions of that person, you could identify the one thing that would actually make a difference.
Right.
So the first step for me is just really asking a lot of questions, and also being able to, and this goes back to the vulnerability piece, being able to relate to people. I feel like when it comes to diet, not a lot of people are super vulnerable, and the fitness industry puts out a lot of messages that like you have to be perfect and orthorexic, and if you're not like, you know, biohacking the shit out of yourself, that you're doing something wrong. And I think that creates some shame for some people, and they don't feel like anybody else deals with the issues they deal with. Like when I'm doing intake calls with people and I'm asking them about their struggles, they're like, oh, you know, I don't know if anybody else experiences this. And I'm like, I'm raising my hand. I'm like, I have experienced that. And we have hundreds of clients who said the exact same thing. So I feel like being able to just authentically share from my own experience, my own pain points, and really anonymously being able to say, I have so many other clients in your shoes is really helpful as well, in order to form that connection where somebody feels comfortable talking about some of the things from a food perspective that they might not normally think to talk to if you were just hammering that masculine perspective of here's the 5-step system, here's the macros. If you don't fit, then what's wrong with you? So, you know, I think that's the most important first step, especially for any coaches listening, if you really want to be connecting deeper with your athletes. And then from there, man, one of the big habits that I like to get people to change within our first 90 days working together is creating the space for inner work. Because I get everybody to create some space for meal prep, and then I always they can do whatever falls in the spectrum for them that week. And then the same thing, if you carve out an hour of Michael time to do your inner work, to do your personal development per week, what that looks like might shift, but at least you've created that space for yourself.
And then the sky's the limit. That's badass, man. Exactly. That's a cool way to influence people. And what one thing I found really interesting is the piece about asking more questions. Something I've been working on recently as a coach and as a teacher and leader is a concept that I learned recently called minimally supporting people. Giving them or teaching them the least amount possible so that they can do something for themselves. And I find that asking more questions and just listening and allowing people to come to their own conclusions is a much more effective way to teach people, because then they're kind of telling themselves to do it rather than me telling them to do it. So that's really cool that's the way you're approaching things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's super important. I like to give my new coaches this writing prompt, and it goes along the lines of, all right, so you're walking down the street in your hometown. You know this place like the back of your hand. And a couple tourists come walking up, and they're like, hey, you know, we're really looking for some good coffee. And you start telling them about this place that's super fringe that you absolutely love. It's your favorite spot. They play your favorite music. They have your favorite art on the walls. And then the tourists look at you and they shake their head and then they go walk towards Starbucks. That's the writing prompt.
And then just write about what comes up?
Yeah, write about what comes up.
Ah,
you just gave them the best recommendation ever and they walked towards Starbucks.
Right.
How do you feel? What comes up for you?
Wow. Oh, that's interesting, man. I'm going to try that.
Yeah.
So in the fitness space, we've seen a lot of evolution over the past few years. We saw people, you know, the CrossFit kind of come onto the scene, and people go from doing bodybuilding workouts to going into these high intensity functional fitness workouts. And they were doing one workout a day. And then we saw people going to two times a day, two a days, getting some extra strength work in. Then we saw, you know, three to four hours a day. And there's just all of these people training like really high level athletes. And now I think we're seeing a reverse effect where more people are just feeling really beat up. And they're going to things like the Ido Portal style of training, or they're doing trail running, or something completely different, like some unconventional type training. And I think the nutrition world has sort of paralleled this. And I'm sure through the from the beginning of time, nutrition has done this. But where do you see nutrition going in the next 5 or 10 years? Do you see it going to any new extremes, or do you see it balancing out? Where do you see it going?
That's a great question. Huh. I personally, my take on nutrition is that it's not just what people think of as diet. I like to think of nutrition as what you do to nourish yourself. I feel like being in the nutrition space, most people think nutrition, diet, abs, sexy. That's why they come to us. And I believe that that gives anybody in the nutrition space or the fitness space these really sexy fronts, this responsibility to give people what they need outside of that realm. Because like when I had Dr. Kirk Parsley on my show and I was doing a bunch of research on him, he doesn't have much of a social media following, but he's the subject matter expert on sleep for CrossFit, SEALs, like all of these different domains. And he's been on hundreds of podcasts, but the way that I thought about that is people don't connect sleep with their abs. They don't connect sleep with big muscles. So it really, the responsibility falls on the people like us who that's our front to actually bring those other nourishing aspects of nutrition into the mix. And again, that goes back to creating the habits, the environment, and the context that a person can exist in to actually move towards their goals and live a good, healthy life. So I really hope that I see this changing tide. There's a lot more people being vulnerable and telling real stories in the fitness industry, especially in the nutrition and exercise spaces. And I hope that we really create a critical mass where there is a lot more truth in the industry. And I still see all of these crazy fad diets. I think as long as people have a short-term silver bullet thinking approach, it's going to be hard for us not to continue seeing things like keto is the magic bullet, fasting is the magic bullet, you know, whatever is the magic bullet, because there really isn't. We haven't found it yet. And there's just so many different things that people are looking to do. There's never going to be anything that works for everybody. So I hope to see more good stories, vulnerability, personalized approaches, and diving deeper than the surface level things like exercise and what you eat.
Right. You know, it's fascinating to me that in exercise, nutrition, life in general, it's usually the very, very simple things, like the most simple things that are the most effective, but they're the least marketable. You know, like getting vitamins and minerals from whole dense foods, eating a consistent amount of macronutrients, drinking more water, getting 8 to 9 hours of sleep, like the super simple but powerful things just aren't as marketable. I think we need some t-shirts, man. Simple is sexy.
I agree, man. I had when I was building out my van, I hired a contractor who helped renovate my house growing up to lend me a hand because, I mean, I knew I didn't have all the skills I needed. And every time that I had a vision for something, I was married to the way I was going to get there. And it was always complex.
Right.
I was really married to that complexity. And he would just come in with all of his knowledge. He's 50 something years old. He's been doing this all his life. And he'd just be like, man, you got a great vision, but let's get a simple solution to that complex problem. And man, I feel like that really has parallels to what we're talking about. Most people don't have, I didn't have the knowledge in that situation.
Right.
So I was always looking for, okay, what's this complex way of doing things? I had this vision in my mind of how to get there. And the easy way just seemed too easy. But he came in with all of his knowledge. He could have told me how to do the complex way, but bringing it back to the fundamentals, what was simple and what was going to work and get me to my vision faster really helped. And yeah, I think that has big parallels to what we're trying to do.
Yeah, I want to talk more about the van and what you're learning there. But before we move on from nutrition, you have a great way of looking at body image and a really cool story that really highlights it. Can you tell the I don't even know what the story, the river story about body image?
Oh man, I'm excited about this one. So this is the story of the naked truth. First time that I saw a bunch of my friends naked, and first time they saw me naked. So I was out in Australia at the end of last year, and a buddy of mine had invited me to come enjoy this three-day glamping trip for the new year with a bunch of his friends. And everybody there had their superpower. You know, we had people who were emotional healing experts, movement experts, body work experts. Everybody had their thing. So we're going to hold workshops twice a day, and we're just going to draw someone's name out of the hat to figure out who's going to hold the workshop. And first day, we all get there. We're super excited. My buddy, Chris, the Naked Truth, his name gets pulled, and he just has this devilish look on his face, man. He's just like, oh, I know what I'm going to do to these people. I'm going to break this weekend open. So everyone's almost nervous. Like, what is cooking in his brain? So he's there with his wife and his son and some of his best friends and family, and they all hop into his car and they go out somewhere. He's got to go get some special ingredient needed for the experience that we're about to have. So he comes back. It's time for his workshop. Goes into the trunk of his Subaru, pulls out this giant bucket. His son's helping him, carries it over, plops it down. And it's this super blue, like Avatar color clay. So he starts explaining what his workshop is going to be. He's like, you guys know that I'm the Naked Truth. I'm like, yeah. Okay. What are we going to get to? What kind of truth are we going to be diving into? So he's like, all right, so what we're going to do is we're going to take this clay. We're going to rub it all over our bodies, and we're just going to get super primal, howl at the moon. And then we're going to go hop into the creek, wash it off, you know, whatever didn't serve you this year, whatever you let go of while you're howling at the moon, you know, that's washed away in the water. So Aaron's like, all right, you know, I don't want to get my clothes dirty, whatever. And he goes, and I'm the Naked Truth. So we're doing this without clothes. If you don't feel comfortable with that, you can leave your clothes on. But he was like, you know, if you also don't feel comfortable with it, you can take your clothes off and face out from the circle, because we put that bucket of clay in the middle. And everyone is so shy, taking their clothes off, covering themselves up, facing away from the circle. You could tell that body language was really contracted. You could see it in everybody, because I'd been naked in front of people before. So I'm just running frontal first into the pot of clay. So I'm observing all this happening, and I see this snicker on his face, because as soon as you catch someone else naked and they catch you naked, then you start opening up. Everybody, their body language started opening. And then all of a sudden, it's like we got into this space of being kids playing naked on the playground again. And everyone's body language completely opens up. Everyone was free for the rest of the weekend. It was great. And one of the big lessons that I took from that, from a body image perspective, is everybody was so worried and in their own head about what everybody else would think about their naked body, that they forgot, oh, wow, everybody else is in their own head about what everyone else is going to think about their naked body. they don't care about what they're seeing around them because they're so wrapped up in their own shit.
Yep.
And I think the same thing applies to body image. It's like people have a lot of shame around their body because they probably think that, oh, somebody else is judging me. And maybe some insecure person is judging them. But who cares about that person? Everybody's wrapped up in their own shit and doesn't really care that much the way that you think that they do. And that was a big lesson that I got out of that. And it was just such a funny thing to see that constricted, contracted body language just opening up and being so free. And if you can really let go of that shit, you can be that free, happy kid who just doesn't care and does what you want.
Yeah, that's awesome, man. I don't think I've told you this. We had a similar experience in Burning Man this year at this huge outdoor shower. And nice. I've danced naked around people and stuff like that before. And so I was a little more bold going into it. And Adi, this was like one of the biggest fears in her life. Just to make a long story short, we end up dancing to EDM music naked with 500 other people and very quickly realized every single person is like, they have their own insecurities, and the just like looking at in people's eyes and not feeling a bit of like creepiness or judgment or whatever was one of the most freeing things on the planet, because we grow up with so much shame around sex and around being naked, and it was just none of that existed. It was a really cool experience.
Dude, that's awesome. I'm so stoked to hear that you two had that experience. Yeah, because I know just from, you know, hearing Adi talk about her past that, you know, that must have been a thing for her.
For sure. For sure. She got out of there.
What came up for you there?
For me?
Yeah.
I'm thinking back to it. I think I just felt extremely human. You know, it's like, it's the most natural state you can possibly be in. And I just felt so human and so connected to everyone else around me, because I know how I guess I haven't spent that much time out of the state, so I don't know how other people grow up, but I know that every person I grew up around grew up with the same, these same feelings around sex and being naked and, you know, whatnot. And it's a very constraining and shameful feeling a lot of times. And there's a lot of fear associated with it. And I felt this feeling of just being completely free. And there was an acknowledgement that everyone in that room felt the same feeling. And it was just this huge feeling of expansion and almost like celebration for all of us to get to experience this at the same exact time. It was beautiful, man.
Oh, that is awesome, man. Yeah. I love hearing that. Thanks for sharing.
Absolutely, dude. So now you're living in a van down by the river.
Yep.
Where did the inspiration for this come from?
So I was traveling. I had been in a relationship where we lived together for 3 years and totally nested up. She had a 9-to-5, so she got 7 days paid vacation a year. And despite the fact that I was working remotely, I was relatively restricted in my travel to her schedule. And as soon as that relationship ended, I was like, wow, you know, I've really built my business to the point where I can do this anywhere that I've got an internet connection. So I ended up going out and for about a year, just kind of vagabonding out of a backpack, just traveling the world, spent a lot of time in Australia, as I mentioned. And towards the end of my time in Costa Rica, actually, I was really feeling like I missed my family and I was missing having consistent habits and routines. Because a backpack is not a consistent environment that I could tie habits and routines to. So every time that I changed the place that I was in, it was like everything was out the window, fresh slate, and I had to start putting roots down again.
Yep.
And that that process started getting a little bit exhausting. And the impetus for the van is I was really feeling like, oh, I was seeing all this, these people, these van lifers. And I had a friend who was doing it. I was like, wow, you know, if I had my kitchen with me, if I had my exercise equipment with me, if I had my things with me while I'm traveling, maybe, just maybe, I can actually have consistent habits and consistent routines. And that was the real big impetus for it. I thought it was going to happen further down the road, but my brother ended up moving home from Barcelona right around that time that I finished up my time in Costa Rica and was planning on heading to Colombia. And I was like, you know what? I'll pop home. I miss my family, miss my brother. I haven't seen him in a long time. And as soon as I got home, man, I just got on Craigslist. I was like, I wonder what vans are like here. And there were tons, man, absolute tons between New York, New Jersey, and Philadelphia. So ended up finding one that was good price, right move, pulled the trigger and just started building.
So cool, man.
Yeah.
So how have you been, like, what strategies are you using personally to stay consistent in your nutrition while you're traveling?
Yeah. So I have a decent kitchen setup. And I ended up getting the biggest fridge that I could fit in the van to make sure that even if I, because when I traveled across the states, there were some food deserts, man.
Right.
There are some places where you walk into a grocery store and you can't find a good piece of produce or anything of any kind of quality. So I wanted to make sure that no matter where I was at, out in a campsite, in a food desert, wherever, I'd have some food available. I really did have to change my cooking habits though, because I was a big fan of the slow cooker, baking things, and I don't have an oven, and a slow cooker takes way too much energy for an off-grid solar setup. So,
gotcha.
Yeah. So I've been doing a lot of stuff on an induction cooktop and really just learning what makes the most sense. I've been using my spiralizer a whole lot. That's a good way for me to get root veggies and things of that nature in. And it's really something that I had to figure out at first. I have some things I'm focusing on. Like right now, my goal is pretty much get 50 grams of protein at breakfast, and then the rest of the day falls in place in terms of my protein. And I try to eat something green at every meal. And if I can check those two things off, I tend to, all the other habits kind of fall in place.
Right.
You know, if I do those two things, then that puts me in a pretty good frame of mind. I think it's important for people to realize, like, there's kind of this halo effect that works two ways. It's like, if you're eating a bunch of good food, you're going to want to keep eating good food.
Right.
And then there's also the issue where it's like, you know, sometimes people eat a bunch of good food. You eat a salad at lunch and then you're like, I ate a salad at lunch, so I can do whatever the hell I want at dinner. And for me, putting that, I have to have that healthy thing in every meal really helps me just construct the meals in the best way.
Right.
Yeah.
Very cool, man. So I want to finish here. I know that you're working on your storytelling abilities. And
yes.
First off, I want to commend you because you've told a lot of stories today, and I it's definitely something that I also want to improve. And so I'm constantly watching how and listening how other people are doing it. And you're doing a great job, man. Your pace and your tone, and it's very suspenseful. So I want to commend you for that. And then also, what are you learning? So first off, why is this something you want to improve? And then what have you been learning?
So the why, one, this is one of those things that is like fire or dogs. It is so deep in the human condition. We've been doing oral storytelling for so many generations. I feel like it's one of those things that every single human has the capacity to do and to connect with. And I think that that's very important. I also think it's important because I had an experience that I used to think I was a long-term thinker. And then I had this experience that got me thinking generationally. And I just feel like the energy that I can put out with stories is something that will transcend my memory. And if I can tell the right stories and shift the tide of the stories, that I'll be creating a good future context that I hope my ancestors can end up living in. So, you know, it's just really, it really came about when I started thinking in this generational way. And the more I've been studying storytelling, the more I realize that that's the way that we learn. There's been, I feel like, you know, there's a lot of people who say that we're coming to this age where there's going to be a balance between the masculine and the feminine. And we see that shift starting to happen. And I think for so long,
what does that mean for those who aren't
Yeah. So, you know, the masculine, it's very thinking about, okay, this is the 5-step process. And then for the feminine, it's very, you know, we're getting in touch with the emotional aspect of things and going in that direction. And I feel like what we've been doing has been like, okay, these are the 5 steps that you follow in order to get shredded abs. And then now there's a little bit different shift that I think is happening where we can tell stories that people relate to. And, you know, if you give me a list of 5 things, I might remember 1, I might remember 5, but I'm going to forget 2, 3, 4.
Yeah.
But if you tell me a story where 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 are encoded and embedded into the story, I'm going to remember all 5 of those things because they're a part of the story. Or I might remember 3, but as I reflect on the story and I get to a point in my life where I'm ready for the other 2 things that I didn't quite pick up on,
right,
then that's the power of the story. It, like, where you're at in your life or where I'm at in my life, hearing a story, we're going to pick up different things, different lessons from it. So, you know, I think that that's the really powerful thing about stories that I want to be connecting with.
So cool, man. Yeah. It's just a way to influence people, in a more powerful way.
Yeah. Big time.
So what are you learning? And were there any moments on the podcast where you were consciously using any of the skills that you've been working on?
Yeah, man. It's funny. My brother texted me this morning. Was like, "Whoa, dude, you're getting way better at telling stories." Nice. Thank you. Yeah, because for me on my podcast, like, I really just want to dive in and tell a story. And I've really tried to find the best storytellers that I know or know of, and just listen to their stories and through that tease out what the commonalities are, what stylistic choices they've made are, because there's a lot of different storytelling archetypes. And I really love a lot of different NPR podcasts, like, completely not fitness related, but I've been saying that I want the Beyond Macros podcast to be the Planet Money of fitness. Mm-hmm. I want it to focus on a topic and I want to tell a story about that topic. And I feel like that's the type of storytelling I want to do with the podcast. And when I hear NPR producers talk about what they're looking for out of getting tape in interviews, they're not looking for, again, that, like, what are the 5 steps? They can concisely put that into narration, right, which I try to do on my show. They're looking for, what were the emotional aspects of that? How are you feeling? What do you think about that? And then they can use that they call it the golden tape, and they can use that to color the story and color the narrative rather than having somebody tell the 5 things. Cause then, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 on the list, you might forget those, but again, you tell a story, you'll probably retain it better. So I think those types of oral storytelling with podcasts, and then a former guest on your show, Mark England, I've been with him for a week. That guy is, dude, he is such a good storyteller. Every night he's had me just, like, on the edge of my seat with the story.
I know, dude.
It's insane. So, you know, he's a guy that I look up. I really look up to the guy and his storytelling ability. So if I could be like Mark England, I'd be very happy, man.
It's crazy how a lot of the best speakers in the world or best teachers, like, when you hear an interview with just someone that is just an incredible speaker, they're asked they could even be asked a tactical question, like, what's the best way to approach nutrition? And they start their answer with a story, because that's what people really connect with. And then they'll say, and that's the best way to approach nutrition.
Yeah.
Very cool, man. Good for you. I'm glad to hear. I'm glad to see that it's working. Glad you're on that path, man. Where can people keep up with you personally and find out more about your company?
Yeah. So I think the best place to keep up with me right now is my company. So my company is Beyond Macros. We are nutrition coaches, and I have a podcast, as I've alluded to, the Beyond Macros podcast. It's about, you know, 20 to 25 minute show. We focus on a topic and we get right to the heart of it. Yeah. So they can check us out, beyondmacros.com, Beyond Macros on Instagram. We're on the podcast there. And then I'm slowly starting to get active again on the Instagram at Grocery Ninja. You can see me doing flips and I'll be telling stories on there and musing on life.
Hell yeah, dude. This has been awesome. Thank you so much.
My pleasure, man. Thanks for having me.
Later, dude.
This episode is finished, but your training journey continues. Head over to brutestrengthtraining.com/SSW and grab your free pack of 32 accessory workouts that you can incorporate into your training and start improving your strength immediately. That's brutestrengthtraining.com/SSW.